You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. New York City's Craft Beer Week is just around the corner, beginning Friday, September 24th, and running through Sunday, October 3rd. To kick off the annual series, Whole Foods Market Bowery is hosting a beer and food pairing event in their beer room. Oscar Blues is on tap, and Chef Jacques Gauthier of Park Slope's Palo Santo is cooking up one of his South American delights to accompany. Food tasting goes from 5 to 7 p.m. and beer will continue until 9. With a Craft Beer Week passport, get $3 off a 64-ounce growler fill. Meet Chef Gauthier Friday, September 24th, and enjoy some special tastes on tap and from the kitchen. Welcome to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Erica White, your host, and this is episode 58 of Why We Cook. Second longest running show in network history. So last week, if you were listening to my show, I did a show that was all about honey. Specifically, honey that comes from China that may not even be real honey. And that if it is real honey, it's tainted with banned drugs. And it may or may not be labeled with false countries of origin. So in other words, some bad news honey. Honey you should avoid like a honey plague. Don't get stung by the bad stuff. Buy good honey from good people who keep good bees. And so after I did that show last week about the bad honey, I headed out for a few days of R&R to Portland, Oregon, to spend a little bit of time with my best friend Lisa, who had the audacity to pack up and leave Brooklyn for the greener pastures of the West Coast. They actually first moved down to Durham, North Carolina for her husband's job, spent a year there, and then he got a better offer in Portland, and so they packed up and moved to Portland. So now they live there. And I like both places a lot. I really like Durham, and I really like Portland. And both places actually have really good food scenes going on right now. Pacific Northwest has its own cuisine, and North Carolina has the Piedmont cuisine, and they're both good. But, you know, Portland has that West Coast thing that I love, that clear West Coast light. Something about the light out there is different than here. The gigantic Douglas fir trees, all the pininess, the mountains. It's so nice. It's so not New York, and it's so nice. And whenever I go to a new place, whenever I travel, of course, what do I like to do? I like to go to the farmer's market. And, of course, Portland has a great farmer's market. So on Saturday morning, we headed downtown to the big market that's on the university campus right downtown and started walking around. And since, of course, you know, I love honey, I made a beeline. I couldn't resist. Straight for the guy with a table filled with West Coast honey varietals. I spotted him from 100 feet away. And usually when I travel and I check out markets and there are people selling honey, I buy a few jars of honey so I can try honeys from around the world. But the TSA, your government, considers honey a potential weapon, sort of like hair gel, and you can't bring it on the plane. You might, I don't know, put it on the pilot's hands and they'll be too sticky and he won't be able to steer the plane, or I don't know, something like that. And being my thrifty / cheap self, I refuse to pay to check a bag. And I only travel, if I can, with a tiny rolling weekender size bag so I don't have to check. And you can't carry honey on board. You have to check it in your luggage. So I couldn't buy any honey because I didn't want to check my bag. I didn't want to buy the honey for $6 and then spend another $30 to check the bag. So I didn't do it. But I did taste. He had a lot of tasting jars set out. And I tasted some honeys that I have never tasted before, different varietals that I have never had. And they were so interesting. Now, one of them that I tasted was from a flower called Meadow Foam. And Lisa actually bought a bottle of that. He told me about the flower. The guy was a real talker, like a nonstop talker. So I couldn't quite catch everything he was talking about, but he said Meadow Foam is a flower that blooms in the spring, maybe right after the snow, something like that. I don't know. I'd never heard of it. It was like a mountain flower. But the Meadow Foam honey was so sweet. It was one of the sweetest things I've ever tasted. Like, really, really sweet. It tasted just like marshmallows. Like, lightly toasted marshmallows. Kind of sickeningly sweet. Not at all my kind of honey. But really interesting, nonetheless. Because that's what I find so fascinating about honey. It's sort of like wine, where all the different varietals taste different. And each type of flower or plant makes a different flavor honey. And this stuff, meadow foam, not my kind of honey, but nonetheless interesting. But then I tasted carrot honey. So I didn't know carrot honey existed. Who knew? But of course, when carrots are grown, if you leave them in the ground, eventually the shoots will flower. They'll go to seed and the seeds will flower. Or you'll get flowers and then you get seeds. And he said that the majority of the carrot seed grown around the world actually comes from Oregon. Most of the carrots we eat are grown year-round in Mexico, but most of the carrot seed comes from Oregon. So they plant beds of carrots in Oregon and let them go to seed so they can then harvest the seed. And, of course, when they go to seed, they bloom. So the carrot seed farmers rent out his beehives to come, and he brings them to the field so he can pollinate. Well, not him. He can't pollinate. His bees can pollinate the carrot fields. And then he gets these hives full of carrot blossom honey. So cool. So, I mean, who knew? I had never really thought about carrot honey before. I mean, everything that has a seed has a flower eventually, but carrot honey. And that was more my kind of honey. It was a little bit darker, less sweet, less aggressively sweet, more fruity. Not really carroty tasting, but definitely fruity tasting. It was really good, really interesting. Of course, I couldn't buy any because it's a, you know, it's a weapon. But then I tried his Douglas fir honey. You know, the Doug fir, it's the big tree of Oregon and the West Coast. It's the state symbol, I believe. Now that's my kind of honey. Fir tree honey, pine honeys, those are great. They're really dark. They almost look and taste like molasses. They're kind of tannic and a little bit bitter, almost like pine sap. That's some good honey. I tend to like those darker varieties of honey better. Some people don't like them. They're too strong. They're too dark. They like sort of lighter, more floral honeys. I like those too. I like all of them except that meadow foam. But I really like that Douglas fir honey. I once had some pine honey from Greece that was good, but this was even darker. It was great. It would be great like on roasted sweet potatoes or on like roasted parsnips. Really, really good. If anyone's going to Oregon and is checking their bag on the way home, you want to get me some of that? I'll pay you back. Let me know. But anyway, so I didn't buy any honey, but I did get to taste a lot. And Lisa bought some from him, so we felt okay about all the tasting. And I also let him talk for a long time. And he seemed like he wanted to talk about his honey. So that was good. And I also, walking around this market, ate maybe one of the best nectarines I've ever eaten. And if you've been listening all summer, I've kind of been obsessing about fruit, talking about peaches and the perfect peach and all of that stuff. And I had a nectarine that was really, really close to perfect. It may have been perfect. So that was very exciting for me. And then, of course, some exceptionally good sheep's milk cheese, which I got made from, you know, local organic sheep's milk, all that, which I did buy and bring home because apparently you can't use cheese as a weapon on a plane the same way that you can with honey. So cheese is okay. As long as you're not going to a different country, of course, you can't bring cheese from another country. But I also bought a handmade dry cured fennel salami, which was great. And I carried that in my bag, too. Now, you could do some serious damage to somebody with a dry cured fennel salami if you knew how. But I cruised right through security with it in my bag, with my cheese and with a big bag of Oregon hazelnuts. So I don't know. What's considered a weapon in food and what's not? It's hard to say. But those Oregon hazelnuts are really super delicious, by the way. And if you've never eaten really fresh nuts before, you would be really shocked at the difference. The first time I ate nuts that were actually fresh off the tree, roasted nuts, it was a miracle. It was like the first time you taste really good craft beer after drinking, you know, whatever you drank in college. It's like that. Anyway, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about some more stuff. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Whole Foods. Whole Foods Market is hosting a beer and food pairing event in their Bowery Beer Room from 5 to 7 p.m. and beer continuing until 9 p.m. on September 24th. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host, and you're listening, hopefully you're listening live tonight at 6:30, but you certainly don't have to because you have many options when it comes to listening to Heritage Radio Network shows. You can, of course, always listen to them live. You can always listen to them archived on our website, heritageradionetwork.com, and of course you can always podcast anything from iTunes. So you have a lot of options. And if you're a host of this show, you can also find it on Facebook. Just search for Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network and leave me a comment or question. Let me know you're listening. So in the first segment, I was explaining about how I went to Oregon and I was visiting my friend and how I tasted some really interesting honeys. And we were walking around the farmer's market in Portland, and I was explaining some stuff about bees and beekeeping to Lisa because she moved away from New York before I started my beekeeping adventure. And so I was kind of giving her like a basic overview about it all. And I remembered that when I had talked about bees on the show last week, that I mentioned that bees produce honey. They produce honey. But that honey is the only kosher food that comes from a non-kosher animal, which I keep coming back to because I find that a really interesting thing. And I thought of this, of course, because she and I were at that point walking around during Rosh Hashanah to, you know, New York Jews, tasting all the different salamis and pork pates that were on offer at the market that week and sort of giggling about it. So she asked why, if the honey's kosher, why the bees aren't kosher. And I speculated that it's because bees are scavengers. They're not. You know, they're sort of lumped in there with the scavengers like the lobsters and the pigs. But it's also because there's something in the Talmud about all the creeping and flying things of the world or something like that. Creeping things. But I think it's because they're scavengers. Not that you would eat bees, of course. But if you were really, really hungry, starving, and kept kosher, and bees were the only food option around, I guess you'd be out of luck. My kosher grandparents never served us bees, only tongue and cold canned peas, if you remember that from the previous show. We didn't eat any bees in their house. So if you're kosher, you can't eat scavengers. You can't eat lobster. It's a scavenger. You can't eat crab, shrimp, none of that. You can't eat pigs, unfortunately. But honey is kosher because it doesn't actually come from the bee's body. It just passes through the bee's body temporarily. It's like, remember that Seinfeld and they had the car rental place? They went to the car rental place and Jerry goes, you know how to take the reservation, you just don't know how to hold the reservation. It's kind of the same thing. The honey passes through the bee, but it's not of the bee. So it's not an animal product. So there you go. So tell that to the vegans, of course, of which there are a vocal many in Portland. It's a big vegan town. Tell them that they can eat honey. They won't eat it. They think it's exploitative of the bees. But yeah, so back to Portland and the vegans. There's a lot of them there. And it's a totally, it's like a city divided. It's like half the people are these kind of diehard vegans and half the people are completely obsessed with meat. It's like the grass-fed burger peoples versus the Boca burger eating people. It's like a bipolar food scene out there. And I have a cousin in Portland who writes vegan zombie novels, believe it or not. He's a animal rights activist, and he writes these fictional books about vegans and zombies. I know, kind of interesting. And then my best friend's husband, who I was visiting, considers pork one of the four major food groups. So, you know, it's a dichotomy in Portland, and we all love a good dichotomy, right? And just as an aside here, did you know that the word dichotomy also refers to a method of execution where the victim is cut in two? I thought that was sort of fitting for this. Does that make the victim kosher? I don't know. It depends if you include the sciatic nerve or not, I suppose. Or if the executioner is using the Talmudic rules of butchering. Who knows? But anyway, if you're interested in reading my cousin's vegan zombie book, it is available on Amazon, and his name is David Agronoff. He is my cousin. I should give him a little plug, even though vegan zombies, I don't know. Not my scene, man. But anyway, back to those scavenging bees. That's what we were talking about. Bees being scavengers. And actually, what I really want to talk about is scavenging, not scavenging bees. So if you've been to the Pacific Northwest in late summer, no doubt you have noticed that the entire region is completely overrun with blackberry bushes. Did you ever notice this? They call them marionberries out there, but they're blackberries. Well, so as an East Coaster, this drove me to near madness. I love blackberries, and they do grow here on the East Coast, but not prolifically, and they're not so easy to find out there in the woods, or at least not where I'm looking. Maybe someone knows a spot. And the blackberries that you buy in the store stink. They're never sweet enough. They're never really ripe. And you spend $4 or $5 for a teeny little box, and within a day or two, they're moldy. So I don't buy them. They suck. I'm not going to buy them. More sucky fruit seems to be the theme this summer. So the first time I was in Portland was like 20 years ago. And I noticed them growing like weeds everywhere. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. But that was before I was really into food. This time, I noticed they're really, really, really everywhere. And I was like losing it. I couldn't believe the bounty, like these big, fat, super ripe blackberries just growing there right in the city, just out of little patches of dirt on the sides of the road, abandoned lots, everyone's yard, on the sidewalk, just everywhere. And nobody seemed to be picking them. It was killing me. Nobody was picking them except me. I mean, maybe by this time of the year that people already have picked their fill, that they've had enough of them. I don't know, but there was this like obscene bounty of blackberries, and I was making Lisa pull the car over a couple times a day just so I could get out and like gorge on them, because it seemed to me like this just incredible waste of ripe fruit. Like they were just hanging there. It drove me crazy. Can you tell? And then we went to the farmer's market and people were selling them by the basket, which I don't understand, because you can just go pick them. I mean, that would be like me going out like onto the streets of Brooklyn and scooping up fallen leaves and selling them at the Union Square Market. Why can't you just go get them yourself? And I remember once somebody talking about that region and saying that the blackberries were actually kind of a big scourge, that they were like a weed and they were insidious and people hated them and they took over lawns and they were full of thorns and they treated them like a weed. But I mean, they're blackberries. They're like the queen of the berry world. It doesn't get better than a blackberry. So Lisa's been looking for a job out there for a while because unemployment is so high in Oregon, and she has a master's degree in urban policy and can't find a job. So I told her she should just get herself a basket and start picking. We have to take another quick break. We will be right back. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Whole Foods. Whole Foods on the Bowery is hosting a beer and food pairing event in their beer room, featuring Oscar Blues Beer on Tap and Chef Jacques Gauthier of Park Slope's Palo Santo. September 24th, the food tasting goes from 5 to 7 and the beer continues till 9. Get a Craft Beer Week passport and get $3 off a 64-ounce growler fill. More information, go to WholeFoodsMarket.com. Anyway, welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I am Erica Wides, your host, and I've been talking about this trip I just took to Portland to visit my friend and how I was tormented, utterly tormented, by all the blackberry bushes growing there that were dripping with fruit, and nobody was picking them except me, and I don't understand that. And so if the blackberries were not torturing me enough, it got worse. Because one night, we took a walk to her neighborhood brew pub. And her neighborhood in Portland is full of craftsman bungalow style houses, which tortured me too, incidentally, because I would love to have one of those. And all the houses have alleys in the back, which is so cool. I love the alley in the back, I guess for like your garbage cans and stuff like that. So we were walking through this alley in her neighborhood on the way to this brew pub. And there in front of us, hanging probably at least 5 feet over someone's fence into the alley, was a massive, gargantuan fig tree, completely loaded with green figs, just dripping hundreds and hundreds of figs on this tree. They were the green variety of figs, not the black figs, and not ripe yet, but only a week and a half away from ripeness. I practically started crying tears of anguish because, yet again, I love the figs. They're not so easy to come by. I don't have a fig tree. The ones in the store suck. A few weeks ago, I did a show about these figs I had been given by a student that were the best figs I ever ate. And there they were, free bounty, just falling from the sky. This tree was huge, and it covered a huge part of the lawn inside of the fence where it was growing, but also a huge area outside of the fence in the alley. It was more figs than I had ever seen in one place before. And you know, if you listen, that I love figs. And figs are not cheap. Now, you could make some serious cash with those green beauties. And yet again, I told Lisa, like, forget about getting a job. Get yourself a basket and start picking. Pick blackberries and go pick figs. Because if she doesn't go pick them, I'm getting back on a plane and I'm going back to Portland and I'm picking the figs. And I'm going to quit my job and just sell figs. So, like, I'm thinking about all of this and I'm thinking, like, urban scavenging is totally underappreciated and unexploited. Because if my bees up there on the roof here in Bushwick can produce honey from the trees around here, from city trees and flowers, why couldn't someone make a living off of foraging urban fruit? Now, I know, I suppose, like, a lot of it is probably contaminated. It's been sprayed. It's probably full of lead from all the old paint. I know. But really, it's probably not much worse than your average industrially grown strawberry, which is also really heavily sprayed. It could have potential being an urban fruit forager. Now, New York City is full of free fruit. Also, it's just not as good. It's full of mulberries. There's a giant mulberry growing here right by the beehive in the back. And there are the infamous ginkgo trees that grow in New York. But I have a mulberry tree up in the country by my little bungalow. And mulberries are nice. They're good. They're good. They're not blackberries, though. And ginkgos smell like puke. And I'm not interested in harvesting those because they smell so bad. But if you walk around Prospect Park in the spring, I mean in the fall, not in the spring, you see all these little Asian ladies collecting them. They take them home and they cook off the pulp to get down to the nut inside. And then you roast the nut and it cracks open. And inside is that ginkgo that they are so driven to get. But I'm not interested in those. So a couple of years ago, I was looking in a magazine and I saw a map that somebody had drawn and published that documented all the fruit and nut trees in LA that overhang people's property lines. Not in all of LA County, but, you know, in LA, the city. And I guess the law there, and I don't know if this is national or not, but it says that if a fruit tree or a nut tree overhangs public space, like a sidewalk, then that fruit is free for the taking. It's public property. So this group in LA published this map, and then they started running these fruit safaris, these like free fruit safaris to scavenge all the free fruit and the nuts. So I went to LA a few years ago to visit another cousin, another Agronoff cousin, and I took that map with me, and I got into my rental car, and I started driving around with the GPS trying to find these trees. But LA is so confusing. Coming from a grid city like New York, LA sort of drove me mad. And I couldn't find parking near any of the trees. And I got really frustrated. And I finally found an avocado tree. But then I couldn't reach any of them. I was having a hard time with it. Very, very frustrating. I need a city with low-lying fruit like blackberries, like Portland. I mean, I probably could have picked 20 pounds of them, and I wish I had. I could have picked them, and I could have brought them back on the plane with me. They're not considered a weapon, not like honey. You know, maybe the canes and the thorns, but not the poor berries. You could, yeah, I couldn't carry like a whole, no. The canes are full of thorns. That wouldn't be good. Anyway, so I was on my way home. I didn't have any berries, and I'm on the plane. And I had to do some work on my laptop because I was getting a little behind on a few projects. And one of them was typing up these recipes for our special events department at ICE, where I teach. And one of the recipes was for an entree using fish called Arctic char. You may have heard of it. And I like to serve Arctic char now instead of salmon. I pretty much don't buy or eat or sell any farmed salmon anymore. And wild salmon is too pricey, and it's seasonal. And we need this menu item to last from September to April. So it's too long of a season. So I'm sitting there minding my own business, typing. And there's a man sitting next to me, and he notices what I was writing and asked me about it. So I told him, we started talking, and I told him, you know, why we use Arctic char. And he pulls out his iPhone and shows me a picture of a gigantic salmon that he caught in Oregon. Big, huge, beautiful salmon. I think in Oregon, maybe up in BC. I can't remember. It was big fish. It was really nice. And he said that this year, the sockeye salmon are having a much, much better season than anybody ever thought that they would. So that's always good news. You know, sort of think that, like, it's all doom and gloom with all the fish, and then sockeye, boing, they come back with this bumper crop year. So that was good news. And then I got home and I read an email. I get like a weekly email from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. They do their seafood choices site. And they announced that they just started a new partnership with Whole Foods, in which Whole Foods will use the same color-coded system that the Seafood Watch site uses to inform the public as to which seafood choices to make, which is great. So you can get these little wallet cards from Seafood Watch, or you can actually get the iPhone app, which I have on my iPod Touch. But this way, it'll be right in the store, so they're going to color code them, you know, green for best choices, yellow for okay, and red for avoid. And Whole Foods has also promised that by 2013, they're going to stop selling completely all the avoid category fish. So that's really great news, and we want to say thanks to Whole Foods for doing that, and I hope that other stores will follow their example. We're just about out of time. Thank you for listening to my ranting about blackberries. If you know of a place where they grow wild here in New York, please let me know. You can email me and let me know. Otherwise, I'll just have to go back to Oregon. So, see you next week. Good night.